This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. That's why he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Introducing the Star Patrol Spotlight, the most intense flashlight you've ever seen. Compared to two car headlights, the Star Patrol shines up to four times as bright.
That's bright!
Illuminate objects up to a half mile away, even from the top of a skyscraper. The Star Patrol easily lights up buildings from across the skyline.
That's insanely bright!
Push Turbo Boost for a crazy bright boost that's 100 times brighter for 30,000 candelas of mega bright light.
What? That's insanely bright!
With 10 illumination modes, the Star Patrol is a spotlight, floodlight, emergency light, and more. Take care of all your lighting needs with one Star Patrol. Don't settle for dull flashlights. If the Star Patrol isn't the brightest flashlight you've ever seen, return it for a full refund. Go to GetStarPatrol.com for your free turbo boost, plus free shipping and a money-back guarantee. That's GetStarPatrol.com. GetStarPatrol.com.
Hey guys, hope you're having a great day. I'm really excited to talk to you because we have so many different big news stories happening. If there's one thing about the news business, it is recession-proof. There is always a lot to talk about. And this week's no different. We have a really wide variety of news, and I want to get to a couple different things. But first, as you know, I like to start with what I call a mimosa moment. These are the moments in life when you just have to sit back and laugh and maybe drink some champagne, because that's about all you can do. Also, it's difficult to know which news story to start with, so I rather just make us laugh and relax a little bit before we head into the serious stuff, because we have a lot of serious stuff to talk about today. So here's my mimosa moment from this week. My daughter and I were walking through the Houston airport, and as we're walking, my daughter sees a billboard of a Victoria's Secret model, because there's a Victoria's Secret inside the Houston airport. And she looks at it and she goes, "Mommy, that's you." Which, of course, I was like, no, it isn't. But thank you. Thank you very much. It's really thank you. So, you know, I knew that it wasn't necessarily accurate, but I'll take a compliment where I can. A couple days later, I was reading her a book to go to bed. We do a nighttime story time, and we have this Minnie Mouse book with a lot of different little nighttime stories. And in one of the chapters, there is the character of a farmer, a woman farmer. And you know the Disney older woman stereotype, right? It's always an older woman with the gray hair in a bun, kind of like the big bosom, the big tushy. She's kind of comfortable, right? You can imagine her. She has the little round glasses. You know what I'm talking about. She always looks so nice. My daughter points to her and goes, "Mommy, that's you." At which point I thought, is that a compliment? It's not really a compliment. I don't know. I do wear my hair like that a lot. Maybe she just thinks I'm really dynamic, or we need to get her eyes checked. I'm not sure. But at least she's associating me with some beautiful women. And she's not blinded by just aesthetics. So thank you very much, Liberty. That's my mimosa moment. All right, we got a lot going on this week in news. You saw a little bit on our website, Smarter News. Just a quick recap. There's a lot going on when it comes to the presidency. You have the New York Times publishing an anonymous editorial. I made some comments on that earlier this week. We have Brett Kavanaugh, the Supreme Court nominee, in the hot seat, in these hearings that have just been pure chaos. As I was looking to see what I was going to talk to you about today, I was thinking to myself, you know what? Everything that we're thinking is true now changes in an instant if our national security situation changes. If there's a terrorist attack tomorrow, the stories that we are so hyper-focused on today don't mean that much. And the truth is, despite the energy that's being put on these stories and the importance of the Supreme Court or the presidency, here's the big takeaway from the week. Brett Kavanaugh will likely be the next Supreme Court justice, and the president is still the president. So That's the recap on those two stories. Here's what I think are actually the two biggest stories that you should know from this week. And we're going to go overseas for both of them. But they have really big implications for us here at home. And I just want to talk a little bit about why I think they're so important and why I think you should know about them. One of the stories is Yemen. Yemen has been deemed by the UN as the biggest humanitarian crisis in the entire world. Yemen is also a safe haven for terrorists. And what's been happening in Yemen over the last 4 years is a major civil war. You have rebels challenging the established or the nationally recognized government. And so the rebels are backed by Iran. The Yemeni government is backed by Saudi Arabia and the United States. And it's a total and complete mess. Why does this matter to us? Well, you know, why does this matter to anybody? Most of us are never going to go to Yemen. We don't buy anything exported from Yemen. We're not going to touch Yemen in any significant way. But what goes on in Yemen can really impact us. And here's how. I mentioned it's a safe haven for terrorists. Well, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula finds safe haven in Yemen. The chaos, the instability there allows them to hide. And so the United States has had a huge drone campaign to try to take out different targets. We've done that with Anwar Awlaki. You know him. He's the radical cleric that put up a bunch of YouTube videos that continues to inspire young men and women sometimes around the world to take up jihad, to turn to terrorism. He was in Yemen. You had the number one bomb maker for Al-Qaeda, also in Yemen. Reportedly, he was taken out by a drone just recently. We're waiting confirmation on that. He's the guy that taught everybody how to make bombs. He's the guy that, when you look at the English magazine that Al-Qaeda produces, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula produce, Inspire, gave directions for how to build bombs in someone's home. That's how the Boston bombers got inspired, for example. So what goes on in Yemen really does affect us. Here's another way. Underwear bomber. Remember him? He was taught, recruited in Yemen. I will never forget when I was on the air a couple years ago, we got a bunch of breaking news alerts. And when I say I felt the sky might fall, you know that expression, the sky is falling. I really thought it might, because what was going on in the breaking news was the revelation of a massive terror plot. What was the plot? They're going to make bombs and disguise them as printers and put them in planes and explode the planes over the United States. Didn't happen, but it was really, really scary. All of this is from Yemen. This is why this matters. This is why Yemen matters. And that's why we have to keep an eye on what's happening there. This week, the news was that the two sides, the rebels and the established government, were going to meet in Geneva. It wasn't going to be peace talks. It was going to be consultations. And this is the first sort of talks in 2 years' time. Maybe, just maybe, there's something that starts getting some sort of reconciliation here, even though it seems impossible. As of this recording, one side, the rebels, didn't show up. So it's not happening. But we have to watch Yemen, and we have to watch our drone campaign there as well, because there are broad national security implications for us. So I want you to know about that story. Another area where there's a great amount of instability and a great amount of chaos right now is Afghanistan. And we've really been watching Afghanistan for a series of different reasons. Not only this week do we have the sixth American soldier killed in Afghanistan this year, but we're having these murmurs that the United States is going to engage in peace talks with the Taliban. And there's a whole host of different orchestrated events that has happened over the last, you know, week or so. You have our Secretary of State meeting with Pakistan. And we've said to Pakistan, you're not helping us enough when it comes to combating terrorism, so we're going to withhold hundreds of millions of dollars from you. That's been a really tense situation. We've had meetings in India as well. India and Pakistan, of course, those relationships are always fraught. So we're having these very high level meetings in these countries around Afghanistan. And then all of a sudden on Friday, Secretary Mattis appears in Afghanistan for a surprise meeting or series of meetings. And the reports are, and he has suggested, that he sees an opening for peace talks with the Taliban. Now, it's very difficult to unpack all the different terror groups inside Afghanistan. The Taliban itself has never been labeled a terrorist organization. But if you talk to our combat troops on the ground in Afghanistan who have fought the war there, we targeted the Taliban. Of course we did, because Taliban and Al-Qaeda were sort of mished together in Afghanistan. The government would like to tell you that they're separate, but if you're someone on the ground in the war, they were together. And so the question is now, why? Why now? Why would we have peace talks with the Taliban? And a really easy way to think about the Taliban as well, or remind yourself, who are the Taliban? Do you remember the Time magazine cover story where a woman was on the cover? She was an Afghan woman and her nose was sliced off. Do you remember that cover? It made a lot of news. That's the Taliban. That's what the Taliban did. You remember the women walking around the streets with the head-to-toe blue burqas? That's the Taliban. So the Taliban are not the good guys. But we've decided that we think there's an opportunity to engage with the Taliban. This is a really big story. This is the longest war in America. We have put countless lives on the line. We have lost countless lives there. What happens there and how it plays into the whole story on whether or not we're winning the global war on terror really matters. It matters not just for us now, but future generations of Americans to come. So I really wanted you to know about that. But I wanted to unpack it further. And there's one person I can turn to when it comes to these areas of really complex conversations and terrorism. And that's Tom Joslin over at the Long War Journal. He's a senior fellow at the Foundation of Defense of Democracies. And he's a great guy, an expert in his field, and he doesn't parse words. If there's one thing I know we need when it comes to the news and the war on terror, it's straight talk. Like, we really need to know what is going on. And Tom provided some fascinating analysis. I just had a conversation with him, and I want you to hear what he has to say. I started off just asking him a very basic question. Why now? Why are we considering peace talks now?
Well, there's a lot of pressure within the U.S. government to just get out of Afghanistan or scale down to some even more minimal presence. But really, a full withdrawal is sort of what a lot of people want. And that's sort of understandable. We're 17 years in the war, and it's a frustrating experience. We certainly have not made the headway as a country that we'd like, nor have the Afghans. The problem with this, though, is that when trying to negotiate a sort of an out with the Taliban, getting them to acquiesce to sort of us leaving. The problem is the Taliban has shown no interest in agreeing to any of the terms that the U.S. wants to do that. So the big thing that the U.S. wants is for the Taliban to reconcile with the Afghan government. And there's absolutely no evidence at this point that the Taliban is willing to do that. In fact, all of the publicly available evidence says that they are not willing to do that. And so it's a very curious time because you have U.S. military leaders, including General Nicholson, who's on his way out as the chief military commander in Afghanistan, and even Secretary of Defense James Mattis, have been misrepresenting really what the Taliban is saying in order to justify this idea that reconciliation is right around the corner. And we say to people, hey, you know, let's look at what they're actually saying. And when you look at the statements that they're citing, they don't say what Mattis or Nicholson says at all. In fact, what they say is basically, you know, go home, Yankee, we're going to take over. And that's what the Taliban is saying.
Okay, so a lot's going on. I mean, there's a lot of dynamics in play in Afghanistan. And I feel like sometimes when we talk about the country, and when I say we, is the news media, but also just we as the public, we sort of lump together the Taliban, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, you know, all together in what's happening in Afghanistan. So I want to get into some of the terms and what's at stake. But can you just give us a really brief overview of how the Taliban is different than, let's say, Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, or different than ISIS?
Well, we refer to the Taliban Al-Qaeda axis because a lot of what the analysis that's been done through the years has basically been trying to do this, what we call disconnect the dots between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And yet there's a lot of evidence that the two remain in the same trench to this day, 17 years after 9/11. And that evidence has to be sort of downplayed, ignored, or denied in order to justify a reconciliation with the Taliban. So this is part of why what we see a lot of what's coming out of the U.S. government these days are sort of very disingenuous sort of assessments of the Taliban-Al-Qaeda relationship. And I just to take a step back here, just so everybody understands, the Taliban is the biggest jihadist entity in Afghanistan. ISIS makes a lot of noise. They've certainly grown. They're very dangerous in Afghanistan. They commit a lot of high-profile terrorist attacks. But in terms of threatening the Afghan government and taking over the country, the Taliban is a much bigger player in that regard and a much bigger risk to the future of Afghanistan than ISIS is. Now, the Taliban, of course, harbored al-Qaeda prior to 9/11, was allied with al-Qaeda prior to 9/11, and has never forsworn them after 9/11. They've never said we're going to renounce our ties to al-Qaeda. The U.S. government has begged them to do that, and yet there's no evidence that the Taliban has done that. And so what you see now coming out of the U.S. government is this desire to have the Taliban reconcile with the Afghan government. One of the things that they're trying to do is they're trying to basically whitewash the Taliban's relationship with al-Qaeda. So as an example, in June, the Defense Department came out with a report, a biannual report to Congress, in which they said there was no evidence of strategic ties between the Taliban and al-Qaeda. A few things about that. That's a very strong statement to say there's no evidence of something, right? It's not the same thing to say, you know, we don't think the evidence adds up to strategic ties between the two. They didn't say that. They said there's no evidence of strategic ties. That, as far as I'm concerned, is a flat-out lie, and here's why. First of all, al-Qaeda, this is something that's not talked about a lot, but al-Qaeda is still very much alive in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And the head of al-Qaeda is a guy named Ayman al-Zawahiri, who's been in the jihad since the 70s, and he's the successor to Osama bin Laden. Well, Ayman al-Zawahiri has sworn what's known as a blood oath, a bayah, to the head of the Taliban. So the head of the Taliban is a guy named Habibullah Akhundzadeh. He's an ideologue, a rigid ideologue. He actually sacrificed his son in a suicide bombing in 2017. That's how committed he is to the cause. Now, actually, I want listeners to take a step back for a second on that one. Just think about it. The U.S. is saying we're going to negotiate a reconciliation or a peace deal with the leader of the Taliban who sacrificed his own son as a martyr to the cause.
Well, and I had to stop you there too, Tom, because based on just the limited amount of information, I know there's so much more that you've just told us. It's enough for me to ask the question, why would we ever sit down across the table from this group? I mean, what are the arguments to do that?
Well, this is why you have to whitewash the Taliban in order to justify it. This is why you have to play disconnected dots on the Taliban's ideology, their ongoing alliance with al-Qaeda, what the group represents for the future of Afghanistan. There's just a broad push to disconnect the dots on all that.
And is that because people really believe it? Like, they really believe that the Taliban is not as bad as X, Y, and Z? Or are they doing it for their own political, you know, upward mobility or political pursuits or their own agenda?
My guess is it's probably both. There are probably people who fall into both camps. But, you know, listen, Jen, I'll give you a stunning example. So last year I was having a meeting in the old executive office, or maybe even the West Wing, I forget exactly where it was, with a very senior White House official, somebody who reported directly to the president on these issues. And this person told me that most of the analysts in the intelligence community at this point, the U.S. intelligence community, the way they treat the Taliban or talk about the Taliban, they're de facto Taliban apologists. And that to me is shocking. I mean, that is basically shows a complete moral and intellectual erosion when it comes to our thinking about our jihadist enemies. And so what I said was, well, let me give you my facts, my evidence on what I think the Taliban is and how it behaves and its alliance with al-Qaeda, and you see if they can knock down what I'm saying. And of course they couldn't, right? I mean, basic facts show you that they're wrong. Just basic facts, basic stuff. Like I just said with Ayman al-Zawahiri having his blood oath of allegiance to the head of the Taliban. If that's not a strategic tie, I don't know what it is. But I'll give you one more. Here's one more very important strategic tie between the two. The military warlord of the Taliban is a guy named Siraj Haqqani. Siraj Haqqani comes from a family known as the Haqqanis, funnily enough. And the Haqqanis basically were al-Qaeda before al-Qaeda. So they incubated the first generation of al-Qaeda. They were Siraj's father, Jalaluddin, who the Taliban had just said has passed away. Jalaluddin was the first benefactor and real ally for Osama bin Laden in South Asia. Jalaluddin was a key player here in basically building up al-Qaeda's strength in the region, giving them a base from which they could operate. And Siraj Haqqani, his son, is the overall military warlord of the Taliban to this day. Well, Siraj Haqqani is absolutely in bed with al-Qaeda. We know now from bin Laden files that recovered during the raid in Abbottabad that killed Osama bin Laden, that Siraj was closely cooperating with al-Qaeda in the battlefield of Afghanistan. There's abundant evidence that Siraj is an al-Qaeda guy. So if you think about this, so you have on the one hand, you have the Defense Department saying there are no strategic ties between the Taliban and al-Qaeda. And yet what I just gave you were some basic facts saying that there's a strategic tie to the number one of the Taliban. In fact, the number one of al-Qaeda has his allegiance to the number one of the Taliban. And the number two of the Taliban, Siraj Haqqani, is in bed with al-Qaeda and has been for decades. How, just even based on those two basic facts, how you can claim there are no strategic ties, which is what the Defense Department says, or no evidence of strategic ties, is really beyond me.
Well, you said a couple things there. Let me just generalize all of them together and push back a little bit about what we're supposed to do next. So basically, I mean, generally speaking, the Taliban are not good people, right? They're the bad guys, but they're in cahoots with these other bad guys. Again, very simplifying this in Afghanistan. But despite them all being bad and despite them not having access to some of the technology we have access to, we have not been able to win in Afghanistan. So our strategy has not produced the results that we want it to, whatever, right, however we would define that. So if we haven't been able to win, is this something we should pursue to try something new? Or I'm looking for something that would a perspective, no, you know, like after 17 years, right? After 17 years, you have to think to yourself, all right, well, this hasn't worked. And the Taliban still to this day has not been deemed a terrorist organization, right, Tom? They're not within the...
Well, this goes to the heart of the problem, though.
Right, that and that's always been the case. So, but this, and so loosely, right, isn't it loosely that they're not deemed a terrorist organization because basically they only terrorize their own people, they don't terrorize us? I mean, is that, that's it, right?
No. See, this is it's worse than that. So let's take this. Let's break this down for a second. Actually, the U.S. government's position on this is completely illogical, and I'm going to explain why. So two things. So the Haqqani network. Remember, I just said the number two of the Taliban is Siraj Haqqani. Well, he and his network are designated terrorists. They're designated terrorist organization. Yet they are running the military operations of the Taliban. So to claim in the U.S. to not designate the entire Taliban is sort of ludicrous when their top military warlord is actually designated as a terrorist and his entire Haqqani network. And you can even see in the Defense Department's own reports that they have warned about the Haqqanis taking over the Taliban, control of the Taliban, or increasing their influence anyway within the Taliban. So there's just a basic logical disconnect here, right? I mean, this is a case where 1 + 1 doesn't equal 2 in the U.S.
Have we just been illogical for 17 years? Because we've never deemed them. Right. So you're saying we've always wrongly assess the enemy.
We do not know our enemy in Afghanistan. We are strategically confused. So when you say, you know, we haven't defeated and we haven't worked, well, there are many reasons for that. I'll give you one. One of them is that we've assumed for years the Taliban. Now, remember, I just said that in terms of threatening this Afghan state and taking over territory, the Taliban is the biggest actor in Afghanistan. There's just no question about it. The biggest threat. It's far bigger than ISIS, even though ISIS is a dangerous threat and a virulent threat itself. Yet for years, we've pretended like the Taliban is not our principal enemy and we don't really need to fight them directly. We're going to train the Afghans so the Afghans can eventually defeat the Taliban. So this has led to a very big disconnect where we have Americans serving in Afghanistan, but they're not really, for the most part, at war with the Taliban. They're basically supporting the Afghans' war with the Taliban. Now, this becomes completely illogical again because earlier this year, the Taliban briefly took over the city of Ghazni, which is a significant city. And of course, the Afghans couldn't eject the Taliban themselves from Ghazni. So the U.S. went in and they had to very quickly provide all sorts of logistical support to the Afghans to kick the Taliban out of Ghazni. You know, our U.S. soldiers, we have suffered several of them were wounded, there were Purple Hearts distributed. It goes to show at one level, the U.S. government is saying that the Taliban is not our principal enemy and we don't really need to fight them. On the other hand, we actually do have to go fight them quite often. And so, we would say they've been our enemy all along. We've just been in denial. And so at the end of all this, it is, you know, sort of an argument that cuts both ways. I mean, if we are this bad at this, if we're this confused about what we're doing, then of course you could interpret that as an argument to say get out. All we're saying is let's not whitewash the Taliban or try and explain away what they are, or who they are, or what their intentions are. And I'll give you another example. You said, so they're only terrorizing their own people. It's actually far worse than that, though. So one of the things that has been found out is that the al-Qaeda has big camps in Afghanistan, or has had big camps in Afghanistan in recent years. These have been sponsored by the Taliban. And the al-Qaeda's operations from these camps stretch throughout the region. And in fact, just days before the 2016 presidential election, a very senior al-Qaeda leader was killed in a drone strike by the U.S. This is a guy who was supporting the Taliban's insurgency in eastern Afghanistan. He was a big player in the Taliban's insurgency in eastern Afghanistan. He was killed in a drone strike just days before the 2016 presidential election. The big reason why the U.S. had to kill him was he was planning attacks against the U.S. from inside Afghanistan while he was supporting the Taliban's insurgency. These are the types of uncomfortable facts that people just are trying to whitewash now as we head for the door. But the bottom line is I just gave you some brief examples of how the Taliban, what happens in Afghanistan doesn't stay in Afghanistan. It has regional and global ramifications. And one other more quick point. Ayman al-Zawahiri, the head of al-Qaeda, just recently released a message in which he explained that the Taliban's Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, which is what they're trying to resurrect, is the nucleus of the caliphate that al-Qaeda is trying to resurrect. And this is broadly misunderstood. Everybody focuses, somewhat understandably, on how ISIS built its caliphate and sort of has lost a lot of the ground that they had. People forget that al-Qaeda is still fighting to raise its caliphate, to resurrect an Islamic caliphate. And what Ayman al-Zawahiri said to his legion of followers, this is everywhere from West Africa to Southeast Asia, what Ayman al-Zawahiri said to al-Qaeda's followers around the world, and they are in the tens of thousands, is that the Taliban's Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan is the nucleus of the new caliphate that we're building. Well, my argument is, wouldn't it be something if we take away ISIS's caliphate and hand al-Qaeda the crown jewel of its caliphate at the same time?
I mean, it's so frightening. I still don't understand why we've never deemed the Taliban a terrorist organization. And I don't say it lightly. Well, they're only terrorizing their own people. It's just that's been the explanation over the years in my reporting that, you know, the Taliban is not on the same level as the Haqqani network or as Al Qaeda at large. But it's very confusing. It's very confusing just to think about it that way.
Just think about it. I mean, so this is why we call it disconnect the dots, right? Because the Haqqani network is the Taliban.
Right. Is that makes sense of what you said. So our listeners know too, and you said it too, that the Haqqani network is one of the more brutal, if you look at different branches of Al Qaeda, like militaristically sophisticated and capable. Is that right, Tom?
They're the ones that executed the largest bombing in the history of the war in Kabul, and killing, and wounding, hundreds upon hundreds of people. They have an incredible attack network, and they are this is a crucial point we try and get across to everybody. Is look, third grade logic tells you there's a problem, right? If you say the Taliban isn't a terrorist organization, but the Haqqanis are. But the Haqqanis are the Taliban. In fact, the Haqqanis and the Taliban both bristle at the notion, ironically enough, that the Haqqanis aren't the Taliban. Anytime anybody says, oh, the Haqqanis aren't the Taliban, the Taliban says, yeah, they are. And the Haqqanis say, yeah, we are. And the Haqqanis have literally been a part of the Taliban since the 1990s. This is indisputable. And to this day, the number two in the Taliban is an Haqqani.
Okay.
So it's sort of ridiculous, for the U.S. government or people in these positions to try and claim that they're not the one and the same. And in fact, they are one and the same.
A simple question that's probably complicated in its answer. What's at stake here? What's at stake if the United States government does move forward and negotiate some sort of quote unquote peace with the Taliban?
Well, I think that the terms of that agreement would not be favorable to us. We're showing that we're desperate here. The Taliban isn't. So this would not be an agreement that would be very beneficial to whatever our interests are in Afghanistan. The second thing is, I think that we risk injecting the global jihad with more juice, more venom, if we withdraw and the Taliban takes over Afghanistan. Even if they don't take over the entire country, if they take over a lot more of it, which I think they certainly would, and basically say that once again their Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan has been resurrected, and al-Qaeda would immediately come out with a video saying, we told you we were going to beat the Americans, we were right all along. The Mujahideen, the jihadists, claimed victory over the Soviets in the 1980s and early 1990s, and that gave us the first generation of problems when it comes to jihadism, and it's something we're still living with to this day. Can you imagine what the message would be to the thousands upon thousands of people who are attracted to this cause if al-Qaeda says, hey, not only do we did the Afghans and their Arab allies beat the first superpower came into Afghanistan in modern times, but we just beat the second. I mean, I think you're looking at something that would inject quite a bit of juice into their sort of ideology and organization globally again. And ironically enough, at a time when the U.S. government is claiming to have taken ISIS's caliphate away from them. Of course, ISIS is not defeated either. That's a whole other story. But at a time when the U.S. government is claiming to have taken away their caliphate, in the way the Taliban and al-Qaeda looks at it, we would basically be handing them the crown jewel of a new one.
I can't get the image out of my head of the Time magazine article from 2010, the cover piece that had a young girl with her nose cut off. And the covers, the issue of Time magazine said something to the effect, and again, this is 8 years ago, this is what's going to happen if we leave Afghanistan. Because the Taliban had cut off her nose because she had tried to run away from her family, from a disagreement within her family. And that's a whole other side of the story, Tom, about what the Taliban would actually mean for Afghanistan and for, you know, for women and children. I was reading in the New York Times today that they were quoting Secretary Mattis, who said earlier this week, you know, something to the effect that we're seeing hope for negotiations, I'm paraphrasing here, but also admitted that the Taliban had been killing innocent women and children. And that's a really hard thing to reconcile for an average American citizen, being like, that's who we're going to talk to? Like, that's...
Well, I think that this is something that needs to be said over and over again, what you're saying here. I don't think there's any doubt the humanitarian cost of this, of the Taliban taking over more of Afghanistan, would be drastic. And believe it or not, you have Taliban apologists who try and claim that they've moderated even when it comes to women's rights, which is completely absurd. And in fact, a couple years ago, the Taliban took over a city for a couple weeks named Kunduz. And what they did was they immediately went after the female activists in Kunduz, the women who were the loudest, the most outspoken for their rights, the ones who opposed the Taliban in the strongest terms. The Taliban systematically hunted them down right away. They showed that this was a priority, that they were going to kill any woman, rape and kill any woman who stood in their way. And the idea, it's ironic. Some of the Taliban apologists that we've encountered are actually women. And one of the things we always say to them is, this shouldn't be a man-woman issue, right? I mean, it should be a human issue. This is a humanist problem here, humanitarian problem here. But it's sort of shocking to hear women try and downplay what the effects of an Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan would look like on other women and children. And it certainly is something where you would have millions of people be subjugated once again under the authoritarian, totalitarian Taliban regime. And it's something that needs to be said, because all the people who are advocating for that a withdrawal from Afghanistan is necessary and we don't have any interest there and let's just get out and forget it. What I say to that is, listen, I understand the frustration. We have many objections to how this war has been prosecuted, certainly. And we can make the argument for withdrawal ourselves. But one thing I'm not willing to own, and if you're arguing in term for withdrawal, you are going to have to own, is what happens to these people once the Taliban takes over once again. And it's not going to be something pretty to watch.
What's the best case scenario, as you see it, just moving forward in Afghanistan for America?
For America, I don't know at this point. I think we've been lost. I recently wrote a very long article, 5,800 words on this. We've been adrift for a long time. We don't really understand. We just don't even know what we're doing, really. And that's a big part of the frustration and that we understand people have with the war in Afghanistan. The best case scenario, I think, is that the Afghan government somehow proves to be more resilient than they have been. But I think there's not even a lot of good reasons to think that will be the case. I think the Afghan government, if the U.S. were to withdraw, say, within the next year, year and a half, I think the Afghan government would be very quickly pressed into defense on more ground than it is today, that they basically would find themselves on their back heel very quickly. And I think that recent events in Ghazni and elsewhere have proven that that's the case.
Okay, just a final question as we wrap things up. I always like to leave our listeners with something that makes them smarter about a certain situation. So if you could give us one thing to consider when it comes to Afghanistan, the way forward and the current state of national security, you know, something that you've encountered over the years that you think is a really important fact that American citizens should know. Does anything pop to mind?
Yeah, you know, this is a startling fact. In October 2015, the U.S. military came out and said that they had to raid what was probably the largest al-Qaeda training camp in the history of Afghanistan, in southern Afghanistan. This is 2015. This is not late 2001. This is not 2002. This is 2015. They're saying that they had to go in and wage a four-day campaign on what was probably the largest Al-Qaeda training camp in the history of Afghanistan, approximately 30 square miles. What's shocking about this is that the U.S. government had drastically underestimated Al-Qaeda's footprint in Afghanistan because all these issues have been thoroughly politicized and because people have wanted to get out for a long time. This is that should have been the type of moment where people woke up and said, uh-oh, we've been wrong here. We need to do a real back-to-basics, ground-up sort of analysis of what's going on. Instead, there was sort of a brief admission that there was something wrong with the previous analyses and that they were getting it wrong. But it seems to have reverted right back to the same old disconnect the dots type of stuff, where people are downplaying, once again, the Defense Department and various other parts of the government, downplaying the extent of Al-Qaeda's presence in Afghanistan. And what I say is, if Al-Qaeda had that big of a camp in one location, why are we assuming they don't have others that are also going undetected? And I just want to leave people that thought, you know, prior to 9/11, up to 9/11, you can remember, you go back to those days where you saw the guys training on jungle gyms and sort of this rudimentary training camps in Afghanistan. It was as recently as just a few years ago that the U.S. found one of the largest such facility that it has encountered throughout the entire war. And that's pretty striking.
You can catch all of Tom's work at the Long War Journal. That's longwarjournal.org. You should definitely check it out. Do not be intimidated. There's going to be a lot of crazy headlines. But to be honest with you, I rely on this site all the time when I really want to know what's happening in the world when it comes to the global war on terror. Our thanks to Tom. Thank you so much as well for your support of Smarter News. As always, if you have a story that you want us to check out, I can't wait to hear from you. I really can't. And I need to think of a better email than info@smarternews.com. But that's the email. So definitely drop us a note. Let us know what you think, what we could do better. And we can't wait to hear from you. In the meantime, have a great day wherever you are. I'm Jenna, and this is Smarter News.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. That's why he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.